just ask a quick. I've never read the book, but there was a television adaptation of it. It was quite good, I think. And in the end, in the union meeting, I don't know if it was used in a real union. I'm just going to ask you a question. They called it the OBU, the one big union. Was there ever such a union? I imagine it's something to do like the IWW, because I think that was very strong in Australia.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer. Anybody else know that? It wasn't called that in the book.
No, I've read the book. No. I did read it. It was a faithful adaptation of the book.
Yeah.
It's only a minor point that we've bogged down on.
No, that's right. Anyone with this relates to that? Oh, yeah.
It's just a very quick minor point.
Yeah.
Did Lawrence write any plays at all, as opposed to short stories?
Yeah. I think the most well-known is The Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd. But... there's another one called Touch and Go. I've never seen it. I think I've seen Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd on television some years ago. I can't remember much about it. And there's one called David. So, yeah, they exist, but there's only three as far as I know. That, I think that's a fairly complete list. So I was hoping to get people... going on this question of whether it got any relevance for us today.
The questions are so weighty that they could have asked it's taking time to adjust to a response to it. You've always had that strain in Australia, I think that sometimes called its most benign form, working class conservatism, and in its more nasty aspect, fascism or fascistic organizations. That bigger middle, it's still very strong in Australia. I don't know about the name actually, the RSL. Return service and leave, very incredibly strong. And it's true that for those part we take the credit of organizing social collapse, but most of it was going on just drink beer and gamble and poker machines and this sort of thing. Nevertheless, they are a very strong pressure group, and it is as well for any government in power to lend a sympathetic ear to what the return service men are trying to say on any issue. At any particular point in time. But I really wanted to get on to the other larger questions that I think is wrong with asking as to whether Vax does hardly change. And in a sense, it carries on from what we were talking about last week. This also came up. And how working class consciousness and political attitudes has changed from that sort of twin viewpoint between fascism and what we used to call Bolshevism. Well, I think so. It hardly seems to have changed. You can still point to this tradition in attitudes, political attitudes now. Well, I think, there is a great case for that. I think that's very true. But as to what set of values have got to be the winning values so far as prompting the success of socialism is concerned, it's so true that traditionally we've always thought of those of material self-interest, class interest, the way we would put it in material terms, and contrast this with an attitude of caring for others, more of a set of social attitudes where we find ourselves not simply as from the point of view of economic individual self-interest, but identify with the needs of the whole community. I'm sure he's right there, but perhaps I can ask a question here. Does he not think that what we are seeing in the working class attitudes now is the triumph of economic individualism, of all the attitudes that are associated with that? You find that class attitudes and class identity of these workers seems to weaken the community. And what we've got instead is a very fragmented situation where individuals and workers are preoccupied not so much with class problems but with their own individual lot in life and are struggling against the addiction and gas filling and this fragment attitudes, recursive attitudes onto this, into this level of individual, economic individualism, self-interest, which doesn't really augur well, I don't think, sort of attitude to value that we need to succeed. For socialism to succeed, it's wrong and right. It has to be identity with community needs and interests rather than all these individual appointments. That's not my whole attitude. I'd like to have a lot more to say about it. I don't want to do that, but I'll stop
here. Well, I can't, wouldn't claim to have any answers in this. I mean, I do recognise the trend you're talking about, certainly, and I think it's one which has been consciously inculcated by certainly American and British governments, hasn't it? I mean, this is Thatcherism and Reaganism very carefully trying to balance their fiscal policies and so on, so that they encourage individualism if they possibly can by adjusting their taxation and their public benefits balances and so on. So that is deliberately encouraged. I find it significant that Lawrence, he got a very sure touch. He wasn't terribly good, I don't think, on theoretical stuff, but he got a very sure feel. It's all of a piece, I think, with his being for nature. All of a piece with his being for whether human beings were genuine or not. He was usually right about things like that. They might not have been able to explain why in any scientific sense. And I think he was right, and I think we've all felt it. Why, for example, do we feel so uncomfortable when they all start, when the Labour Party all starts linking arms and singing the red flag and Auld Lang Syne and so on? Because it's phony, isn't it? And I think this is what Lawrence detected in the or expressed in the book as his central character felt about the trade union movement, that their togetherness was phony. And I think it came up very briefly. I was sitting in on a EC meeting. I think this is probably jumping the gun. But there was a discussion about trade union anyway, and a question about women in trade unions and women being pushed out, and the question of whether they actually had been or not. And the thing is that the feelings that trade unionists have got all boiled down in general to, in fact, self-interest for trade. And you can see this when you get a conflict between two related unions, two unions which are in the same business, like printers union as well, like the National Graphical Association and the, I don't know what it's called now, but before they were forced together, and the conflict was tremendous, and yet they were in the same boat. So that the so-called communality or whatever it is a bit phony there. And I wonder whether, I mean, this is just an idea which occurs to me now, the individualism that you'll say is economic individualism and grasping for number one may not be a step in the direction of being able to stand on your individual feet and then start thinking again. I don't know.
Okay, anyone?
Just one other quick point. Did you write any other novels or stories based on Australia at all?
No, that's the only one, and it was because of the trip. Incidentally, he never returned to England after that. He died TB in South France. He went to Mexico after that. Wait a minute. There's this thing, this joint thing with Molly Skinner. I don't know much about it. It's called The Boy in the Bush. I don't know much about that at all.
Program. TV program. There was a TV program.
What's that?
It was an Australian. The Boys in the Bush. I don't know. Maybe it's different.
It was a... No. It's just,
TV program.
You saw it on TV here?
Yeah, The Boys in the Bush. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. It's related to that or not.
No, I don't. Anyway, when he went to Mexico, he wrote a thing based on Mexico, The Plumed Serpents. And apart from stories then, it was Lady Chaplin's Lover was the last novel. There were some posthumous stories, but I'm not sure when
when he wrote those, but it was getting pretty close to the end of his big output.
Did he write some criticisms of novels? I had a teacher once that told me he wrote some criticisms of novels, and that never really be. He said in the book, he said that the people that went to America never went there to fight for freedom, they went there to oppress each other, which I was always thought was very relevant.
Yeah. I must admit, I don't know a great deal about his essays. He did write quite a few. Trying to look for the... he's got here studies in classic American literature, and I'm not sure what's in that. But certainly he did write essays. There's not a lot... I got this from the Cambridge History. There's not a lot about his essays in that. But I know that he did do. And he was quite a good... He was regarded as quite a good literary critic. Yeah.
I think his stuff must be out of print now, because everybody's reprinted them.
Oh, they?
Yeah. Not out of print, out of copyright.
Oh, I see. Yeah. This is part of the... You see how old this is. The Penguin did virtually a complete works back in about
the 50s. When the trial of Latterly, Lady Chatterley, I mean, he gave him a good opportunity to tell all the other Lawrence books.
Yeah, this lot came out before that. Yeah. You had to get the Paris edition if you wanted Lady Chatterley.
Yes, the back.
I don't know to what extent I missed anything you might have said in this regard, so I was held up coming here, but clearly in Kangaroo, which I'm an old one, he draws quasi-fascist characters, situations, but certainly on Plume's Serpent, which rescued not that really. There was a study of a nationalist, fascistic regime being brought into being. And nevertheless, the picture I formed of Lawrence from early reading, not least the poems, was one which found a view put forward by the literary critic Alvarez at the New Left meeting many years ago, describing him as a quasi-fascist or a proto-fascist, particularly irritating because I could see why these professional leftists would be very irritated by somebody who would say, let's make a revolution, but not in dead end. Seriously, just in for the fun of it. And various other skeptical approaches to the revolution, the needs for the working class, which these people would find terribly irritating, and therefore they can quite readily use fascism as a square word. But had you indicated, or do you have some views from other things he's written as to whether one could see in his results, he's talking the actual associations and signs of approval he made of fascist development.
Yeah, I think he quite obviously rejected both what he sees as poles. I don't see them as poles, but he sees them as polar. But coming together in the sense that they are populist. Now, this is what he rejects most, the populist elements. He does not like the people involved. And what he says in this book is, through the mind of this Richard Lovett Summers, what we need are some very powerful big men who will take all the property off the people and stop all this squabbling. In other words, he's quite prepared for a dominated, an aristocratic, as he would call it, regime, but not a fascist one in the sense we must all, the true meaning of fascism, we all stick together and we shall all be powerful under our leader. That's not what he thinks, driven by the mob. It's not what it's for. In fact, the mob is the thing which he detests most of all, wherever it comes from. There is another interesting section in the book, incidentally, two chapters of it, about this man's experience, which again echo Lawrence's, as a being called up for the First World War, and of course he was rejected immediately. It doesn't happen quite like this in here. They play cat and mouse with him, and of course they were in some trouble. They actually literally got expelled from Cornwall, you know, the Lawrences, because the neighbours thought they were on the coast, they were showing lights to the ships and things like that. You can understand how suspicious they were, because forgot his real name now. I keep wanting to call her Harriet. It's in here. Frieda. Frieda was the niece of the Red Baron. Westhaven, that's it. Yeah. And, you know, he got notoriety over here as well as fame over there. And they didn't particularly like this, but of course, anybody who was married to a German. And Lawrence was very anti the war, and they thought that's because he's got German sympathies. I don't think he had particularly. I think he strove for an independent viewpoint. I think sometimes he riddled his way in between other people's points of view so that it would be uniquely known, and therefore I don't think it stands up all that well. But I think that to charge him with fascism is wrong, but he would like to have been an aristocrat. I've met members of the working class like this before. Some of them have got deliberate, exaggerated public school accents and behave, and dress and behave as though they were aristocratic. They like, usually go to High Church of England, you must smell the incense and things like that. I think Lawrence was in that category, if not exactly at that time. He didn't like the squabbling. What he didn't like about politics was all this going after wealth. And, he thought that in trade unions, the working class showed its covetousness, I think he said, something like that. He didn't like that aspect. He said somewhere the working class of Europe are some of the kindest in the world, and yet this is what's happened to them in this society. They become all chasing after earthly goods all the time.
Yes.
Does the novel have, what kind of an ending does it have at the point of view? Is it optimistic at all, or is it the other way, pessimistic in terms of? And indeed,
I would think it's slightly downbeat because they leave Australia disappointed. It hasn't been what they wanted. They wanted a new country which had got new ideals and a new start. And he's found what he thinks are the old problems there. This is, I think, one thing he does do for Australia. It really does. You feel you've got, whether it's accurate or not, some Australians say it is, you've got a picture of the intellectual life at such a sport, and it was pretty poor at that time, and the country, and considering, you know, it was only there a few months, that's pretty clever job was going on there. But I think they leave Australia to get away, not to go particularly to somewhere else. It didn't work for them, both from the Lawrences and their fictional counterparts.
Didn't work for them anyway, did it?
No, it didn't.
Some years back, I'm number now 5, 6, 7 years. I'm number now. I tried, at least three times. This is in relation to how you open up your remarks. I tried three times to read Kangaroo, and I failed three times. Three times
much
I got to the middle, and three times I gave up. Now, I was going to ask you,
how much tougher than you?
Why this was so? Well, I can't remember the exact story of all that. I certainly don't know how it ends. But what communicated to me was the contempt. Underlying, I felt the contempt that the writer had for the characters that he created. And the contempt for everything that he was faced with, for everything that was around him. That's the feeling, as I recall, it communicated itself to me, and I think that's why I got fed up with it. That's not exactly how I felt with other novels like Rainbow and White Peacock. I read those through, and I wanted to read them through. I became interested in the people he was writing about, conditions and so on. But I think to charge a writer with guilt about the words that he puts into the characters they create is all wrong, isn't it? I mean, surely that's the prerogative, the privilege of the writer to create whatever he wants to and make them say whatever he feels the characters ought to be saying at a particular time. And they may not be saying things that you particularly like when you read about them. So that I don't think we can. I've never read anything actually. What the ideas that Lawrence himself harbored,
on an out-and-out basis. I mean, he did write those essays. He was very smitten with the Etruscan civilization, and he was really taken up with that. But we know, and as you say, he was, as a considering his background, he naturally was very pleased to see the backdrop conditions in which of his childhood, and he had ambitions to join the higher ups, the intellectual and so on, intellectual circles. Their influenced his attitude and his writings. I don't think that even throughout his all his writings, and I think we tend to forget that probably among his best writings are his short stories, or his long short stories. This thick at home, almost as thick as a Maupassant volume. And certainly those short stories, all of them, once you start, you can't really put them down. And they all have, they're marvellously told.
Have you read that, the Leavis book?
No.
Have you read that? I think you'd find that quite enjoyable, because he does take the things apart and explain what is so good about them, you know. I accept this point about a writer has a function, whether you like it right or wrong, to create characters and put words in their mouth and so on. The thing about Kangaroo, and one of the things which is irritating, and it might be the point at which you put it down, is the fact that he drops this pretense at one or two places, more than one or two places in this book. I've made a note of one here. I can't actually pick on the words on the page for the moment because it, you know, takes too much time. I've written to myself here, chapter 16, A Row in Town. Here Lawrence makes no pretense of Summer's thoughts being presented. They're delivered straight to the reader, basically religious, having much in common with Hitler's thinking but opposed to the masses. Anti-democracy, quasi-biological claptrap. And that's straight from Lawrence's mouth. He doesn't put it in anybody's mouth here. The chapter starts, the thing that Kangaroo had to reckon with and would not reckon with was the mass spirit. A collection of men does not necessarily mean a mob, and he goes on like that. Now that's Lawrence talking. That's not his his character. And I think that that's one of the faults of the book. And as I said, in another place, he simply says, if you don't like it, don't read it. So that it is Lawrence. I found exactly the same when I came back to it this time. I couldn't go on with the thing, and I eventually thought, well, no, this is not what I got out of it before, and I have to, I've got to try harder. I've got almost all the way through, and I went back and read it again, and when I read it in much more detail and started making notes, I realised that I had been skimming it before. I'd been trying to do a workmanlike job on it, do it in a certain amount of time, and I'd missed a lot, and I went back. I found that the thing started to stand up from the page in three dimensions, that I was getting a much more accurate picture, and I found that there was a story there which I'd hardly detected before, but it's a much more subtle story. It was a story of the interplay of feelings. And I was more impressed than the first time about the actual novel as a story. And I would say that it probably is worth going back again. I won't say that you won't be annoyed. I think you probably will be, because there's still annoying things in it. But I think that they are balanced by the stuff that's worthwhile.
Yes?
I agree with you about his attitude. Extremely irritating. It doesn't have to be anything. And it going in front of this individualistic thing, I think the two of them who mainly wrote about seem to get very domestic. Didn't do anything outside of their homes and gardens, would perhaps nowadays be involved in a play group or a charity or protecting animals in some way. It seems to be looking at that step going on now, people involved in individual ways of trying to save the environment without connecting up to the reasons for the degradation and everything. But the other thing I was interested in was you just now said about this thing about feelings, and that's what I felt about the book. That is the main thing. It's about how people feel about each other, how they approach each other, how they, in an oblique sort of way, is dealing about how they deal with each other. And I kept thinking of Virginia Woolf in the Stream of Consciousness, because that's how I felt about it book, that's really what it was. Which means that it is his feelings coming out, his own thing is coming through in the book as well. I don't know whether you really agree.
Yes, I do. I'm a bit uneasy about the quick generalisation of about the attitude to women. It's certainly arrogance here. I mean, I've written a quote down. No man was beyond woman, but in his one quality of ultimate maker and breaker, he was womanless. Now, I'm not necessarily sure that that means superior there, but there are definite indications where he makes his character say, and I think he may even say himself, that the essence of marriage is the submission of woman to the man. And yet you find him giving women so much importance in his stories. If you look at the characters that he chooses to state the most important things in his view of life and the world, he always picks women. It's the women who see things clearly, it's the women who sense things properly, and he regards many of the men as being crippled by capitalism.
Especially
your brother. Yeah, I suppose so. But I mean, I'm thinking of Women in Love in particular. These are extremely perceptive women. I always get the names mixed up because they're too similar. They're too German, both of them. In The Rainbow, the women in that, and you know, the families in those generations, you know, it's the women who are almost the bearers of civilization. They're the ones who are responsible for life going on and for values being maintained and all the rest of it. So that there isn't, again, a simple answer as to... I say he's arrogant towards them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he regards them as inferior. I don't think he does. I think he regards them as other, except in this business, it's the sexuality business, he regards them as having to submit. And of course, I think part of this was his own problem, because Frieda would not bloody well submit. You see, they had these terrible rows all the time, because she was just as powerful a character as he was. And I think he's dramatising this in his books all the time, because he can't win this particular domestic battle.
Yes.
I think it's really important that he as you say, he does think that women are important, but I suspect that he's saying that because he's talking in terms of a return to nature rather than, as you say, women fall in civilization. I'm not sure about that. I think a bit somewhere around how women were the embodiment of humanity and they were the bedrock on which everything else was built. But he thinks of them as the bedrock in terms of fulfilling their position in nature rather than advancing themselves within the civilization which they find themselves, rather than perhaps sort of learning and academic skills or something like that.
I'm not sure. I'll have to go back to this chapter, because then I think maybe it does pull some of these things out, and it's now 3 weeks since I read it, so it's getting a bit hazy with my memory. It would be odd if that were so. I mean, I know that you're talking almost of the German Hausfrau image, aren't you? The Nazi image.
No, it's one of his
others.
I can't remember
which one
it was, but I think it might
be
another one. I'm not sure now. One of those in particular, he mentions this about women being in the home, providing the safety and the continuity of the race.
Yeah, though if he does that, don't forget that I think that this is what Lawrence thought valuable in life. Yeah. I mean, he rejected he rejected mechanistic civilization as near as he could. So that if he does allocate that to women, that's what he regards as being important.
There's another side of the thing. Surely there's a famous small story where, obviously set in Italy, although we don't specify, where the woman runs away from London with her little boy, and she, for all intents and purposes, obviously, Lawrence was very much taken up with Italy, particular part of Italy, and he describes how this woman gives herself to the sun, as it were. She lies and revels in the sun, and it describes how the husband, who is obviously a man in the city, something in the city, comes to visit her, and
the utter contempt he has for that man, as opposed to the woman who's giving herself to totally natural feelings. There, it's a different kettle of fish altogether. The contempt is for the man and his way of life, and the commendation is for the woman and the way she's giving herself to the son and life. So very certainly I can't see where you can pick up this anti-woman attitude. Perhaps even describing what the position of women in society at that time. I remember it's 60, 70 years ago, so
yeah.
There was a considerable difference, and maybe often all this function of the writer to describe as well as do other things. So he was describing what the woman's condition and situation, and certainly in that story, there wasn't condemnation of women, conflict, anything, the condemnation of man, or more particularly the condemnation of lifestyle, urban lifestyle.
Yes, I think all of those things are true. I think we may be wiser not to try and generalise again, because every time we come to try and put him in a pigeonhole, he keeps slipping out of it. I mean, there are parts in this, the domestic bit, you know, because they're moving into these rented houses and they're in kind of poor condition, and Harriet's there, he's saying, well, we'll do this and this with the place and we'll make it attractive, and he says she got on with her little domestic affairs. It seems as though you're expected to be contemptuous of this for a moment, and then you get Summers himself saying, or Lawrence saying about the scenery, the table with lovely jarrah wood and so on, and he's got these floors, and he, obviously those are things which matter to him too, to Lawrence, so they may not matter to Richard Summers, who's interested in politics. In fact, of course, Lawrence wasn't a political animal in the end, I suppose Summers managed to be, but I think you also get Harriet in here, probably Frieda did, saying, all right, you get off then and play your silly little political games and I'll get on with the important stuff, you know. And I think, you know, Lawrence suspects this, and Harriet criticises her husband for being so bad-tempered and for changing his mind and so on and not knowing what he wants.